Today at Reader's Corner, Peter Carlson, author of Junius and Albert's Adventures in the Confederacy, a Civil War Odyssey.
Well, they were two young reporters for the New York Tribune, ended up covering the Civil War. They were best friends, and during the course of the war, they had each saved each other's lives. To the reporters in the field, it really didn't make any difference to them whether their newspaper was Democratic or Republican. It made a difference to the Confederates when they captured Albert and Junius. After being in for 20 months and trying to devise elaborate schemes, finally they were desperate and just walked out at the right moment. They were 300 miles behind Confederate lines, so getting out of the prison was the easy part. Getting across those 300 miles was the hard part.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. History books are full of stories about the dangers and deprivations endured by soldiers who fought in the Civil War. What may be less known are the challenges faced by journalists of the day who risked everything to get to the front lines of battle. Two of these daring, self-proclaimed Knights of the Quill are the subject of a lively book by Peter Carlson entitled Junius and Albert's Adventures in the Confederacy, A Civil War Odyssey. Northern reporters Junius Brown and Albert Richardson were captured by the Confederates, subjected to harsh prison time, and eventually made a 340-mile voyage back home. Mr. Carlson recounts their experiences in this book. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Peter Carlson. He was a reporter and columnist for the Washington Post for 22 years, and he now writes a column for American History Magazine. He was a guest on Reader's Corner in 2010 to discuss his earlier book, Kay Blows Top, a Cold War comic interlude starring Nikita Khrushchev, America's most unlikely tourist. Mr. Carlson joins us from his home in Rockville, Maryland. Peter Carlson, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. Happy to be here.
I was down in Asheville, North Carolina with my wife, and we were visiting Malaprop's bookstore, and there you were giving a presentation on this book, so we had a chance to connect personally. And I must say that I think we talked a little bit about, I mentioned that you may have that there's an option on the book, K Blows Top. What about this book? This book would make a really interesting feature film. Anybody bite yet?
I haven't heard of anyone who wants to do it, although it's when I first heard of this story, I thought, wow, that would make a great movie.
Yeah.
Much more so than K Blows Top, it seems to me, but I don't know. No one seems to be interested thus far. The rights are available. Anyone anyone who has a few extra, you know, millions of dollars to make a movie can just give me a call.
So, getting back to Asheville, North Carolina, the mountains where some of this book takes place, the trials and tribulations of Junius Brown and Albert Richardson, the most famous or infamous prison they were assigned to was in Salisbury, North Carolina, which is, I guess, about an hour and a half east of Asheville. I found it fascinating to watch you as an author turned into presenter. And then, of course, take Q&A from the audience. And for me anyway, and you may not remember this because you're doing these things every night, and you have, I'm sure, come across every kind of question you could ever imagine. But in your book, you talk about the mountains, the western mountains of North Carolina, as a refuge for all kinds of people going back to the Civil War, folks in the South who did not want to sign up with the Confederates. I even remember stories when I lived down there about Vietnam draft dodgers who found the mountains as a place of refuge. The Scots-Irish originally settled those mountains. They were escaping from oppression of the Crown in Great Britain. So these are folks who, generally speaking, have a culture of not liking government. And so you finish your presentation in Asheville, North Carolina, and this guy comes up and monopolizes your time after the Q&A period, who is clearly right from the cloth. He is your typical anti-government hater. He wants Peter Carlson to go on record agreeing with everything he says. You handled it very skillfully, obviously from many, many hours of dealing with audiences and having to take all kinds of questions. You get that very often, especially as you tour with a book like this in the very areas where your book is covering the culture, so to speak?
I didn't get too much of that. I was kind of disappointed, actually. I had thought that I would get a lot of neo-Confederates.
Right.
who would attack me for writing a book in which the Confederacy is not glorified. And in fact, every time I went up to a podium, I carried in my pocket the famous speech of Alexander Stevens, the Confederate vice president, in which he said that the Confederacy was built on the idea of slavery, because I figured somebody would tell me that the Civil War had nothing to do with slavery. But that never happened. So maybe those folks have died out, or maybe they don't come to these bookstores.
Right. Well, at least one of them showed up on that evening, but as I said, you handled it very well. Well, let's talk about Junius Brown and Albert Richardson. Who were these guys?
Well, they were two young reporters for the New York Tribune. They were old friends. They'd been friends for a decade. They met when they worked for rival newspapers in Cincinnati before the Civil War in the 1850s. And Albert was a kind of a handsome, stocky fellow from a farm in Massachusetts. He didn't like farming. He wanted to be an explorer of the Wild West. And so he headed west in his teens. And in Cincinnati, he got a job on a newspaper and found out that he was a really good reporter. He had that great reporter's ability to walk up to strangers and start talking to them and have those strangers want to tell him things. So he turned out to be a very good natural reporter. His buddy Junius, not so much. Junius was kind of a scrawny guy from a rich family in Cincinnati. His father was a banker. He was sent to a Jesuit school in Cincinnati, where he studied ancient Greek and Latin and French and a lot of other very tough subjects. He was kind of an intellectual. He went into his father's bank, and he hated that. And so, like Albert, like many people in newspapers, he went into it looking for a job that was a little more exciting than what his father wanted him to do. And they became good buddies and ended up covering the Civil War sometimes together, and sometimes they would be traveling separately. One point when they traveled together is, of course, when they got captured.
And I kept waiting as I was reading of their separation. I kept waiting for them to go off their own direction, lose contact with one another. They were through thick and thin, and I figured at some point that would challenge their friendship. But from what I can tell, these are two gentlemen who maintained that friendship not only before, during, but also after the Civil War.
Oh, yeah, they were best friends. And during the course of the war, they had each saved each other's lives. So there was a very, very strong bond there. And they were imprisoned together. And of course, being in prison, it's nice to have somebody to watch out for you, to cover your back. So they were very, very tight friends.
I'm sure you can appreciate this, but as I was reading the part about each of them working with different publishers to record their observations, their story, to tell this narrative of what happened to them, I thought, aha, this is where it's going to break down, because these guys now are kind of competing with one another. But even that didn't do it.
No, that didn't seem to be a problem, although it didn't hurt their friendship. I think Junius took it a little more seriously and spent a little more time writing the book. Albert kind of banged his out very quickly. The two memoirs they wrote were among the first memoirs to come out. They came out right after the war ended. And they were both bestsellers in their day.
And were they major sources of your material as to what happens along the way here?
Oh, yeah. The two books were the main source. And then there was the letters that they wrote back home and the letters that they wrote throughout the war and from prison to their managing editor of the New York Tribune, Sidney Gay. Those letters were found by Sidney Gay's grandchildren in the early 1950s in a stable on Staten Island where Sidney Gay, I guess, housed his horses. And they're, most of them anyway, perfectly readable. So they're at Columbia University now, and they were a huge source for me also.
Sure. Well, they worked for the New York Tribune, a northern paper that was an abolitionist paper. That was Horace Greeley's paper. I guess the question I wondered about was how many Junius Browns and Albert Richardsons were there running around the South as northern reporters covering the war?
Well, there were quite a few reporters with the Army, certainly. I have no number for it because it constantly changed. But there were reporters from northern papers with all the Union armies. Sometimes they would get a little disillusioned and switch from one to the other, always looking for an army that was going to do something as opposed to an army that was going to sit around and wait. That was a problem early in the war. But there were dozens of reporters, and a lot of them knew each other. They'd worked together previously, or they'd met each other at different battles, and they formed this unofficial organization they called the Bohemian Brigade, which was kind of a tongue-in-cheek way of saying that they were going to try and have as much fun as they could covering the Civil War.
So were Junius and Albert's escapades in the South, until the time they got captured, I mean, were they more independent of the armies? You mentioned that these reporters hung out with the armies. Did Junius and Albert hang out with the armies as much as these other guys did, or were they more vulnerable because they were out there on their own?
Well, all the reporters were on their own. There was no embedding. But if you had credentials, I guess you could show up at the army, and if the general was interested, he would let you hang out. A lot of the generals were eager for publicity. Some, like General Sherman, detested reporters and were liable to lock you up. Sherman did. So they would hang out with an army as long as they were getting good material, and then when they weren't, they'd switch and try and find an army that was more interesting.
Our guest today is Peter Carlson, author of Junius and Albert's Adventures in the Confederacy, A Civil War Odyssey. What about the concept of objectivity in reporting during the Civil War? How would that compare to the way reporters handle themselves in the Iraqi War or whatever war these days?
Oh, there was no idea of objectivity then. I never saw the word mentioned in any context in the Civil War. All of the newspapers had editorial policies. As you mentioned, the Tribune was an abolitionist paper. Horace Greeley was an early supporter of Lincoln. But there were reporters from the New York Herald and the New York World, which were Democratic papers. They supported the war, but they did not support Lincoln. But the reporters may have had different opinions than the newspaper owners, and they decided during the war that basically they wanted to just tell people what was happening in the war and let the editorial writers back home sling opinions about it. So to the reporters in the field, it really didn't make any difference to them whether their newspaper was Democratic or Republican. It made a difference to the Confederates when they captured Albert and Junius, because they usually released reporters, but they hated the Tribune. So the Confederate in charge of prisoner exchanges basically told the Union, we're not going to release these guys because they're the most obnoxious prisoners we have. We hate the Tribune, and that's the way it goes.
When it comes to this issue of reporters getting arrested by the Confederates, was that common? Were Junius and Albert exceptions to the rule? When they were first captured, I assume the Confederates didn't really know they worked for the New York Tribune. They had to get that out of them. The actual act of capture, I guess, is what I'm talking about. How prevalent was that as far as reporters were concerned?
It happened fairly often. Albert and Junius ended up being in various different prisons, and in all of them, they ran into other reporters who were captured. The only difference was those reporters were usually released pretty quickly. By quickly, I mean within a month. Some of them were held a little bit longer, but Albert and Junius were held for 20 months. So it was fairly common for an army to capture reporters because the reporters were trying to get as close to the action as possible. And the reporters, you know, were not likely to run because they figured, oh, we'll be captured and then we'll be released. Unfortunately, it didn't work that way for Junius and Albert.
So tell us about these prisons. How many were they in and what was life like there?
Well, they were captured in Vicksburg and were sent to Richmond to supposedly be released. So along the way, they stayed for a night or two in maybe five different jails. But basically, they were held in three prisons, two in Richmond, Libby Prison and Castle Thunder Prison, and then one in Salisbury, North Carolina, Salisbury Prison. Well, let's take them one by one. They were in Libby Prison for the summer of 1863. And life wasn't too bad there. I mean, the food wasn't great, and they were locked up. But it wasn't as bad as Libby Prison later got. Then they were shipped down the street to Castle Thunder, which was a horrendous prison which housed civilian prisoners or Southern Confederate soldiers who had done something bad in the Army or who had tried to desert the Army or runaway slaves. So that was a horrendous place. But fortunately for Junius and Albert, it was run by a guy named Captain George Washington Alexander, who was crooked. And he enabled folks who had access to money from outside the prison to buy their way into what amounted to a country club prison inside the prison, where they got better food. They could buy food from vendors in the city, and they actually had a stove for the winter months. They could heat it up a little. So they were treated fairly well in Castle Thunder because basically they were bribing their way into better treatment. Then they were sent to Salisbury, North Carolina, in February of 1864. And they were very happy to get there at the beginning because the prison had a yard outside, a few acres, where they could play baseball, and which was better than sitting inside in an old tobacco factory in Richmond. So that wasn't too bad for a while, until the fall of 1864, when the South sent all the prisoners out of Richmond, which was besieged. So 9,000 people showed up in Salisbury, which had previously housed from 600 to 800. So suddenly it was very overcrowded. There were 9,000 guys living in the exercise yard outside, and it was cold and rainy and snowy, and life became very, very horrendous there. Prisoners were dying at the rate of about 24 a day by the time Albert and Junius escaped in December of 1864.
You know, as I read the book and thought about Salisbury, North Carolina, I've never been there, but I wondered how towns like this deal with this kind of history today. Is there?
Well, I went there and spoke at the library where I had done some research. They have a lot of information about the prison there.
Is it like, I hate to use the word tourism, but is there some aspect of tourism for people to come and see? I mean, wasn't there burial grounds where thousands of bodies were dumped right outside the city?
There is, yes. There is a federal cemetery there. I don't know how many people go there. I would recommend that people go there. It's quite a moving thing. If you know the story of the prison, where these men would die at the rate of, as I said, of about 24 a day, they would strip them of their clothes. The other prisoners would take the clothes because they were freezing. And they would take these carts of naked bodies and throw them in a long ditch, maybe 100 yards long. And there are something like 12 ditches now that you can go and see. And there are some headstones that just say Union prisoners. And there are some monuments that some people from the Union Army later made, you know, decades later, erected outside. If you know the story of the prison, it's a very, very moving place. But I don't know how many people know that story, and I don't know how many people actually show up to see it. I spoke there, and I got a large crowd because there are a lot of people in town who are interested in the prison. And they were very friendly and took me around and showed me where the prison used to be, which is now a neighborhood. And I'm going back in April when they have an annual conference about the prison. So I'll be speaking to people who are really into the history of the prison.
Well, Junius and Albert thought that they were going to be part of a prison swap. How did Civil War prison swaps work, and why didn't it work for them?
Well, early on in the war, they came to an agreement, and they decided they would swap prisoners based on, you know, if you had 100 privates, you'd swap them for 100 privates, or if you had captains, you'd swap them for captains. But that fell apart. It worked for the latter half of 1862, but when the Union Army, as part of the Emancipation Proclamation, started having black soldiers, the Confederates just went berserk, and they thought this was the most horrendous thing, that you would have Negroes fighting in your army. So they quickly announced that they would kill black prisoners that they captured, and that they would kill or sell them back into slavery, and that they would execute the white officers of those prisoners. So the Lincoln government said, well, you know, if you're not going to exchange all our prisoners, we're not going to exchange prisoners. So that pretty much killed the prison exchange program. There were some small exchanges, informal exchanges after that, but there were no large exchanges. So that's why you started getting these horrendously overcrowded prisons in both the North and the South. Albert and Junius figured they'd be exchanged, and indeed they were paroled. They got the documents saying you're going to be exchanged, but when the Union Army asked for them, Robert Ould, the Confederate bureaucrat in charge of exchanges, wrote back and said, we're not exchanging these two guys. They work for the Tribune. We don't like the Tribune. so we're not exchanging them. So they learned pretty quickly that they weren't going home. They kept trying. They hired a lawyer in Salisbury to try and get them out, but there was no getting around Mr. Ould's obstinacy. So the only way they would get out was to escape, and they finally did.
How'd they do that?
Well, ironically, after being in for 20 months and trying to devise elaborate schemes, they ended up just carrying boxes. They worked at, in the prison hospital, and they were allowed certain privileges because they had to carry medicines back and forth. So they ended up just carrying boxes to look like they were on an errand and just walking out the gate. It was strange because for months they tried to devise the perfect escape, and you know, they found problems with each plan they had, so they never executed them. And finally, they were desperate and just kind of walked out at the right moment. And then, of course, they were 300 miles from the nearest Union Army behind Confederate lines. They had to go across the Blue Ridge and the Appalachians to get to the Union Army in Knoxville. So getting out of the prison was the easy part. Getting across those 300 miles was the hard part.
Our guest today is Peter Carlson, author of Junius and Albert's Adventures in the Confederacy, a Civil War Odyssey. Well, and this, I think, is the most thrilling part of your book. Obviously, Interstate 40 hadn't been built yet.
So, no, that was still in the future.
Right. So these guys are, and it's winter and there is snow. But tell us about what's going on in these mountains at the time. You have the Home Guard, the Bushwhackers, the Heroes of America. You have the mountain poor and the flatland aristocrats, and trying to tell the difference between the two so you don't give yourself away to the wrong side. This was an incredible challenge for these guys, not just the physical aspects of it, but also the mental aspects of it, if you can, trying to psych out who you can trust and who you can't.
That's true. Well, Salisbury is kind of in the flatlands, and for the first 4 or 5 days, what they would do is walk at night, heading in the direction they hoped was north, and they would stop as dawn approached and knock on the door of a slave cabin. They figured the slaves would be sympathetic to them, and they found that in every instance the slaves were. The slaves would hide them for the night and feed them, I mean, for the day. They couldn't move about during the day because they would be captured. So at dawn they would find a slave cabin, the slaves would hide them and then feed them, and then they would take off and walk all night again. So that worked fairly well. Then they got into the mountains, and the sociology of the mountains was much different. It's tiny farms up there, subsistence farms. Most people, the vast majority, did not own slaves, so there are very few slaves. Many of the people in the mountains were opposed to secession because they figured, hey, we don't have slaves. Why should we care that Abraham Lincoln has been elected and that the rich slave owners want to secede from the Union? So in all of the mountain areas of the South, in Virginia, in North Carolina, in Tennessee, whenever they held an election about secession, the mountain counties voted against it. So there were many Union supporters, or at least people not who didn't support the Confederacy in the mountains. But of course, there were many pro-Confederates too. And as these guys started traipsing through the mountains toward Knoxville, there was no way for them to tell if any individual person was pro-Union or pro-Confederate. So they had been initiated in prison into a secret organization called the Heroes of America, a pro-Union secret society, which had, you know, secret handshakes and secret passwords and stuff. So that helped them in the mountains. So they were helped by Union sympathizers all the way. There were some points where they had no one to guide them, so they had to guess. And they had been taught that the poorer the person was in the mountains, the more likely he would be a Union sympathizer. So when in doubt, they would go to a humble cabin as opposed to a brick house. And fortunately for them, they never guessed wrong. They would have been shot by the Union guerrillas up there if they had been carrying rifles on several occasions. Because, as you mentioned, there was a guerrilla war going on in the mountains. If people have seen the movie or read the book Cold Mountain, that took place in the same area, and it was pretty accurate in its description of the sort of guerrilla war that went on there. On several occasions, Union guerrillas saw these guys traipsing through the forest and thought they were home guard and would have shot them but they noticed that they weren't carrying any guns, and they knew the Home Guard would definitely have not come through those areas unless they were heavily armed. So it was very scary out there in the mountains, and of course, the physical problems were bad, too. It was the middle of the winter. It was December or January. There was a lot of snow on the mountains. It rained a lot, and they were soaking wet and freezing almost all the time.
To your point about their going up to these cabins and seeking help and assistance, oftentimes it seems they were women who answered the door and who took care of them, and that's where you taught me a new term that I had never heard before, lying out. There was a reason for why the woman was answering the door instead of the man.
That's true. The women were home. The men in the area were either out fighting for the Confederate cause, if they were pro-Confederate or had been drafted, or they were guys who had not wanted to fight for the Confederacy, so they dodged the Confederate draft, and they would leave home and live in caves in the mountains, and their kids or their wives would bring them food or signal to them in various ways, like hanging a certain quilt out to dry, indicating that it was safe or it was not safe to come home. So there were all these guys in the mountains who were draft dodgers. Plus, late in the war, there were a lot of guys who had deserted from the Confederate Army, took their rifles with them, and they heard that in the mountains you could find people who were sympathetic, so they would head to the mountains. So you had these encampments of guys who were either draft dodgers or deserters from the Confederate Army who were living in the mountains and fighting with the Home Guard. So Albert and Junius encountered bands of them, too. It made for quite a scary and adventurous trip through the mountains.
So you and I talked before the show. This book is a thriller, whether you know the ending or not. And in this case, of course, they do make it to Knoxville. And in a sense, at this point, it almost feels like present-day Washington, D.C., because these guys actually go into Washington and testify like we see on TV all the time today.
Yes, they made a solemn vow in the mountains. Albert had written down the names of every Union prisoner at Salisbury who had died and passed through the hospital. He was the clerk of the hospital. He knew all their names. There were, just parenthetically, a whole bunch of people who died out in the yard who they didn't know because the people out there wouldn't say that these men had died in the hopes that they would get their rations the next day. So they were saving that information so that they could live. But anyway, he had written down well over 1,000 names of people who had died in the hospital, and they made a solemn vow in the mountains that if they made it back, they would go to Washington and lobby to do something for these poor prisoners at Salisbury. So when they made it, they fulfilled that vow, and they immediately went to Washington and testified before a congressional committee about the horrendous conditions in Salisbury. And I don't know whether it was cause and effect, but shortly thereafter, the Union and Confederate armies did manage to come to some kind of agreement, and the Salisbury prisoners that remained were released, although the ones who were able-bodied had to walk 50 miles to get to a place where they could then be shipped to the Union lines, and many of them died on that march because they didn't have much food and it was freezing out.
Well, we've run out of time, and I must say that I haven't had a chance to cover the colorful cast of characters who helped Junius and Albert as they made their way through the mountains, nor have we touched on the final ending of this book, which was really a surprise to me, and we're going to leave it right there so our listeners can go out and enjoy this as the thriller that I enjoyed it. It's Junius and Albert's Adventures in the Confederacy, a Civil War Odyssey. Peter Carlson, thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Peter Carlson. Next week, Rod Grammer, author of the novel The Good Assassin. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.